So much interest in our Oregon income tax system. For those of you who made it in this morning, this is committee orientation on the tax system. Again, for those of you who have followed revenue before, you know that we spend a good part of our first few weeks on orientation just because things tend to get so complicated, and it's good to have a common base of knowledge as we get into the session. So we will take our time getting background on issues and the tax code today, specifically with regard to income tax. And so for that, we welcome Elizabeth Martin Mahar. I don't know if you've met the committee yet, but Elizabeth is one of our staff economists. And if you may recall from last week's first meeting, was introduced as being our income tax specialist on staff. So, Paul, do we have anything else we need to address before we got bill introduction after?
Okay, afterwards.
Okay. Yeah, we can do that after. Make sure everyone sticks around for the big action this morning. And with that, then, Elizabeth, we'll...
If I can add anything. I just wanted to remind the committee, and I think on the discussion we had last Thursday on the overview is to remind you that your basic facts document that you got, we'll pretty much follow that. And if you look kind of back on some of the issues we talked about on Thursday, are in the first section on the overview. I've got some information there on the history of the budgets. Page A6, for example, shows state budget history over the last 10 years, summary of all of our taxes. So that material is there, and I think that addresses some of the things we talked about. And then if you go beyond that into the next section of the C1 section is the income taxes, and that gives you some background information on what Elizabeth will be talking about today.
Okay. Elizabeth, welcome.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, for the record, I'm Elizabeth Martin Mahar with the Legislative Revenue Office, and I'm the personal and corporate income tax economist. And today we're just going to go through the personal income tax system. And next week we'll kind of split it out and we'll start in focusing on the corporate income tax. We'll also have a brief discussion on the surplus sticker today and also some proposed legislative tax changes. And I'll just go through some key points on Measure 28 and also some federal legislation that's being proposed by President Bush. Now, this is a page in your packet. This is actually in the overview section. This is page A8 of the tax packet. But this is similar to a graph that Paul showed you last week. And basically, with this graph, you can see that from this perspective of 71 all the way till 1994, the property tax system produced the largest amount of revenue than any single other source of tax for the state of Oregon. And as Paul was pointing out last week, in 1990, when Measure 5 was passed, then you saw then this slight reduction here, starting to have a decline then in property taxes, until 1994, when then personal income taxes overtook property taxes as being the largest single source of revenue for the state. And income taxes were always the major source for the general fund, but it wasn't the single largest source, and property taxes were that until 1994. And then, as you see, in the 90s, the personal income tax, grew significantly, all the way to the height of $4.55 billion this is the fiscal year of 2001. And then you see here the sharp decline showing our recession then in the 2001-02 fiscal year. Now, this drop, even though it was a drop of roughly $850 million, we went from $455 billion to $3.7 billion for a drop of $850 million in just that one fiscal year. Now, that may sound like a lot, but on a percentage basis, it's really not as large as the drop that we saw in the corporate income tax area. Now, with corporate, as you can see, during the 80s, and even the beginning of the 90s, corp was pretty constant. I mean, there's a little bopping up and down, but it really did not fluctuate and didn't take, and it started to take off in 92 here. You can see where corporate receipts nearly doubled here. And then by again, the height was in the 1999-2000 year, and then in 2000-01 versus 2001-02, there you saw a drop of nearly, it went from $373 million down to $195 million. So that drop was almost 50% in corporate income taxes on a percentage basis. So that's just the important thing to remember, is the volatility that is now inherent in the corporate income tax, to the point where in one fiscal year it can almost drop 50%. Now, obviously, Pitt didn't drop 50%. If the personal income tax had dropped 50%, we would be going all the way down here to almost, you know, 2,000, and that would be a much larger drop. So just on a percentage basis, this is what we're seeing, is that from the on a biennium basis, you see the same thing. In 1999-01 biennium, we had a total of $10.1 billion. Versus a 2001-03 biennium where there was a total of $9.2 billion. So that drop in revenue of $900 million, it was shared both in the personal income tax as well as the corporate income tax. But the percentages changed pretty significantly between these two bienniums. So in the 99-01 biennium, you saw that the personal income tax was 87% of all the general fund, and it was $8.7 billion, versus it dropped $600 million between these two biennium periods, but the personal income tax was not dropping as rapidly as other components of the general fund. And so then you see that the percentage there has remained the same between the two bienniums. Versus corporate income tax, where in the 99-01 biennium, you saw the corporate tax was 7% or $755 million versus the 2001-03 biennium where corporate income tax is 4% and it's $395 million. So that drop of, you know, 3% just within those different, just within one biennium is quite significant. And we see that other taxes, which includes like the cigarette tax and the gas tax, and it includes excise tax, those grew slightly between 1999-01 biennium and the 01-03 biennium. And what you saw here were then also these non-tax revenues grew from 3% to 5%. And that's really due to the one-time transfers that the legislature made into the general fund revenues. That's where it appears, is in this other transfers. So now to kind of give you a little bit of a breakdown of how the tax system works here in Oregon, and to kind of think about your own tax returns when you file them, and how that procedure is, and what are all the different components in it. You can see that we begin here in Oregon with the federally adjusted gross income. And so everyone's clear here, you know, when we're mentioning the word adjusted, you know, don't think this includes all the different deductions and everything that you get to, you know, have. It's not including itemized here at this point, okay? When we take this federal adjusted gross income, you're talking about total income, which is from all your different revenue sources. And the adjustments then are just including things like IRA deduction, student loan interest deduction, moving expenses, self-employment, health insurance deduction. So those are things that not everyone, you know, most people don't really have a chance to take, okay? So it's not like it impacts everyone. I mean, everyone has an opportunity to take these adjustments, but many people get confused and they think the federal adjusted gross income is like, you know, the taxable income. That's what's applied to the rates, and that's not correct. This adjustment here is not meaning the same as deductions. It's just talking about a few deductions that, you know, not everyone takes. So then after, and another main point with realizing this is where Oregon's taxes begin, as far as, you know, our starting point is the federally adjusted gross income. So we are tied with the federal tax system. And we have a rolling connect, and we have ever since 1997. And we are tied to the federal definition of taxable income. So this is what's, you know, important to keep in mind, is that, you know, when we have changes in the federal tax system, then those feed through. If there are changes that are reflecting our income base, then they will come through and have changes then in our Oregon tax, income tax. Now, next is we see that we add in additions. And what additions are is that's the income that the federal government does not tax, but Oregon does. Okay, so there are things like the interest on government bonds and non-Oregon bonds, also interest and dividends of minor children, gambling losses, which were claimed at the federal level as an itemized deductions are considered in there in the additions. Also, if you're going to take certain credits here in Oregon, like the long-term care insurance credit, then you would need to add those premiums, those federal long-term insurance care premiums, back into your base here. Now, the subtractions are just the opposite, then, of addition. So the subtractions are the income that the federal government does tax, but Oregon does not. So then we're subtracting those out. And this is the largest component of this is the federal income tax subtraction. And right now in 2002, that's set at $3,250. And when I'm saying 2002, I'm meaning the tax year 2002 in which you will file and rectify in April now of 2003. So
that's Measure 88.
That's right. That's Measure 88. Measure 88 was passed and set this federal income tax subtraction at $5,000. And then in the third special session, there was the phase-in bill to phase up this federal income tax subtraction. Then after you've looked at those subtractions, then you begin to move down to the deductions, okay? And those are what most people think of and they remember when they're thinking about adjustments and stuff that are made to your income. But just recognizing that these deductions, you can consider whether you want to have itemized or standard deduction, depending on which one's going to give you the lowest tax. So for most individuals, the standard deduction here for a single person is $1,640. For a joint married couple, it's $3,280. And there also are additional deductions if you are elderly, you or your spouse are over 65 years of age, or you're blind. Then you get an additional $1,000 part of your standard deduction.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just to note that there's no, thanks to this committee last year, there's no longer a marriage penalty there.
That's right.
It's exactly half.
That's right.
I think it used to be $3,000
and
$1,800.
Yeah, $1,800.
Good point.
So, and that's another point, too, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Haas, that the federal government is still having a phase in of that, you know, difference, and they will begin to be moving too to having, you know, this joint being double the single in their standard deduction. So the itemized deductions, I'm a little bit ahead of myself. The itemized deductions are what are reported on the federal return, and then you're going to minus off your state income tax and also if you have any special medical deduction. So, again, we are tied to those deductions that are allowed at the federal level unless we have changes that we bring about ourselves legislatively in a bill in order to change that connection, because we're automatically connected to not only the federal adjusted gross income but also deductions, the federal itemized deductions. So then that, the summation of all of that then creates the Oregon taxable income. And that is the thing that most people get a bit confused on. You know, they know they have gross income, their total amount of salary and interest income and things, but many times they don't know what their taxable income is. So I think the thing to remember, too, when we will be seeing printouts and things during session with different runs, if we have different proposals before us and different changes to the tax system and you want to get a distributional breakdown by different income groups, what it's going to be categorized on is this gross income up here, not on the taxable income, even though, you know, most people don't know what their taxable income is until they pay their taxes. So that's why when we create the tables which give a distributional breakdown, we do it by gross income.
So, Elizabeth, if I can ask you to go back, just again, not to suggest anything or telegraphing here, but just to see how this works, the relationship between federal adjusted gross income and what we do on our Oregon returns. At the federal level, we're hearing about some additional changes in the federal tax code. For instance, the
dividend.
That's right, corporate dividend income, declaring that to be tax-free. Right now, that would affect federal adjusted gross income, and that's how it flows through to us, because you would have lower federal adjusted gross income. So you would start at a lower point for Oregon income. If we were to disconnect to make them either taxable in part or in whole, then that would be something that we would put, that would appear as an Oregon addition to income. Is that right then? So we're recapturing that for Oregon income taxpayers?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Yeah, that would be part of our Oregon additions that we're adding back in.
Okay.
So as you can see, we already have a few of them that we're adding back in. It would just be another line on the tax form.
But otherwise, the change in the federal level regarding corporate dividend income would be picked up in our rolling reconnect. We would automatically connect with that. And it would be, that would show up in a lower federal adjusted gross income.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I may add along that same line of reasoning, the rate reductions that the federal government's proposing will reduce the federal income tax, and that would reduce the subtraction for those who are under the cap, and that has a positive rate on that tax. So we're going to have to weigh the effect of the reduction in the base through the reducing adjusted gross income with the lower federal tax. So those will be the things we'll look at for that impact.
Thanks. Yeah, and I appreciate that, Paul. My purpose, of course, wasn't to suggest we do one thing or the other, but just to show how that flows through on the way we calculate income, and it's a good point that it works both ways.
Yes, and we'll have some precise numbers for you when we can get better information from the Joint Committee on Taxation as they work through that proposal.
Now, to just give you a few highlights, because I know many times people kind of want to know what are the biggest subtractions, deductions, credits. So I just try to give you for the tax year 2000 right here the top five Oregon subtractions. And as you can see, the federal income tax is by far the largest subtraction with $2.4 billion. And I'm sorry, this should be $5.1 billion in subtractions. And then from there, you see that this comprises, you know, nearly 50% of all of the subtraction total is the federal income tax. And then the Social Security income is roughly $1.1 billion, which is, half of what the federal income tax is. And then the others are, you know, quite a bit smaller. You've got federal pension income that is subtracted, and then you've got, like, the Oregon, the kicker checks that we get, $345 million in 2000, and then the interest from U.S. bonds, which were $306 in 2000. And then for your itemized deductions, again, these are the ones that are coming from your federal form, and Oregon is connecting with these itemized deductions. And for tax year 2000, and these are full year returns. The total deductions were $9.1 billion. And with these deductions, you see that the home mortgage interest is really the largest at $3.9 billion. And that's, you know, not quite 50%, but it's 40%. And this kind of gives you an understanding of how advantageous it is to become an itemized itemized deductor using those itemized returns to your advantage when you're a homeowner, because you've got not only the home mortgage insurance there, but you've also got the property taxes, and that's another billion each year. And other charitable contributions is also a billion. And that other charitable contributions is religious organizations, nonprofit organizations are allowed. We have down below another category for charitable contributions just to education, and there's another one of charitable contributions to health organizations. But so this other one is really capturing a whole conglomerate of nonprofit organizations.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Where's the federal deduction on that list, or is that not considered? The Measure 88, the 3,000 going up to 5,000.
Yeah, that is really...
It's the subtraction.
Yeah.
Elizabeth, I'm just curious on the other slide. You've got other charitable contributions and education. So those are, you would aggregate those. That is, the charitable contribution education is not part of the
correct.
Of the billion under other.
It's correct. Okay. Yeah. Mr. Chairman, that's just the way they're split out. Mm-hmm. They just kind of lump all these other charitable contributions, which are all religious, and,
yeah.
but they separate out education, they separate out health. Those are the two they separate out. Now, with the medical and dental expenses, at the federal level, if you have 7.5% of your adjusted gross income as expenses, medical and dental expenses, then you are allowed to have a deduction. And roughly 105,000 taxpayers claimed that deduction in 2000. So that's what you're picking up here with the medical and dental expenses. If you have a lot of medical and dental expenses, $393 million. Now, to kind of give you an understanding, again, like I was just talking about, the top two of those federal itemized deductions are connected with being a property owner. So what we've seen then in terms of this trend over the last 10 years is, you know, there's been an increase here in itemized deductions from in 1990, where there was 423,987 returns that itemized versus in 2000 where there was 671,453 individuals that itemized. So that's an increase of only 36% of the returns using the itemized deduction in 1990 versus 47% of those returns in 2000. And part of this has to be, you know, the increase in home ownership in Oregon and throughout the U.S. And it's due to those lower interest rates that we've been seeing in the late 90s. And also just we've been seeing, as some graphs will begin to show here, a substantial increase in our gross income. And as our income grows, then we're able to afford to buy homes. And so you've gotten more people into homes over the last 10 years. And this basically is showing up then in the number of returns that itemize. Now, as we get back to calculating that tax, we start again with once you've gone from the gross adjusted gross income at the federal level down to the taxable income, then you just take that taxable income and you times it by the tax rate. And in Oregon, we have a progressive tax rate structure of 5, 7, and 9%. And so there's three different brackets, and we'll go into the brackets breakdown in just a minute. But for most people, then, what they do is that when they are filling out their tax form, you just know what your taxable income is, and then you go to the tax tables, and then it shows you, you know, basically what your tax before credits is. So that's what the tax table is revealing for you. And then what you do is, as once you figured out what your tax liability is, then you can look at what credits you may have qualified for. And so the biggest credit that we have and the largest used is the personal exemption credit, which is for every exemption that each taxpayer has. And it is indexed to inflation. So in 2002, we see that personal exemption credit is $145. And then you're going to times that $145 times the number of exemptions that you have in your family. And then once you've calculated how many different credits you can qualify for, then you minus off your credits, and that becomes your tax owed. Now, in 2002, this is the rate structure for 5, 7, and 9. And this has been the rate structure since 1987. So there have not been significant, there haven't been any changes in the tax rates during the 1990s. So with this, what you see is that the single taxpayer, the first $2,500 of their taxable income will be taxed at a rate of 5%. And then their next income group between $2,500 and $6,250 is taxed at the 7% rate. And then finally, what the income that is greater than $6,250 for a single filer is taxed at the 9% rate. It's not like you just fall into one, you know, category and then that's the rate that is applied to all of your tax. It is a progressive tax structure, so every tax return, you know, that is above like $6,250 will have all three different tax rates applied to some portion of their taxable income. And with joint returns, you can see that with the first $5,000 of a joint return has a 5% tax rate applied to it. The income between $5,000 and $12,500 has a 7% tax rate applied to it, and the income greater than $12,500 has a 9% tax rate applied. So this is a progressive tax structure, but you can see it gets to 9% quite quickly. And this is less progressive than like at the federal level, where the federal tax rate structure has six different tax brackets. And it goes from 10% to 38.6% as far as the range of tax rates. Now, if Measure 28 was to pass, then that's where this comes in, is that Measure 28 is just affecting the lowest 9% here, and it's just allowing it to go to 9.5%. So this is just the group or the portion of your taxable income that's affected is that portion that's above $12,500 if you're a joint return or $6,250 if you're a single filer.
Thank you.
Representative Virgil.
Elizabeth, do you have any idea of how many Oregonians will be affected by the 9.5?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Virgil, I don't remember the exact number off the top of my head, but it's around 300,000 will not be affected by the measure because they fall within the 5% or the 7% category, so more than 300,000 are not affected by
not
the measure.
Affected.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now to just give you kind of a breakdown of the tax credits, you can see that the total full-year tax credits were $423 million in 2000, where $361 million of that $423 was the personal exemption credit. So that is by far the largest credit that we have in Oregon. In 2000, there were roughly 2.8 million total personal exemption credits that were claimed. That's about 2.3 personal exemption credits per return. And there were 1.25 million returns that actually claimed this personal exemption credit. And there were only 1.45 total full-year returns filed in 2000. So nearly 80% of the total returns actually claimed an exemption credit. And the ones that wouldn't claim an exemption credit would be ones who were dependents on somebody else's return. Now, the second largest credit is a tax paid to other states at $17 million. And this has to be tax that is paid to other states because the same income was taxed in both Oregon and the other state. Then the third one there, the earned income credit and the working family credit and the child care credit are all designed for families, low-income families that have children. And so for those different working family, like with the earned income credit, it's a function of the federal earned income credit. So you have to qualify for the federal earned income credit, and then you get 5% of that federal earned income credit claimed here in Oregon as a credit. And that's a non-refundable credit, the earned income credit. And that was $10 million in 2000. And the working family credit, which was enacted in 1997, is basically a credit that is a declining percentage of those qualified child care expenses, with the highest rate being 40%. So the lowest income Oregonians who qualify for the working family credit get a 40% credit for their child care expenses. And that is based on you have to be the lowest income group gets a 40%, or have to be 150% of the federal poverty guidelines or less in income. And then the final one.
Before you, a working family, last session we made that refundable, and as I recall, the revenue impact of that was something like $16 million for the biennium. Was that it, Paul? Do you remember? So yes. Would that number then be, because if we're talking 2,000, that was not refundable. So you would have, if it's a $16 million revenue impact on the working family, child care tax credit by making it refundable, are we going to see a jump in that number then,
yes.
Barring all any other changes of, to about $23 million? I mean, if $16 million were, well, so we'd be increased $16
million. $16 million, okay. Yeah.
Yes, but it would roughly double that impact.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, this is the year 2000 before
yeah.
that was refundable.
So we'll,
yeah, that
we'll
is
see some
change
in the ordering of those correct. Credits after 2000.
Yeah, I'm sure working family will overtake earned income and probably even
yeah.
taxes paid
yeah.
to other states. So it probably could become number two.
Yeah.
Now, the final one there was just the child care and dependent care for low-income Oregonians, where you're basically being given a credit for employment-related dependent care expenses that you did incur. And again, that is declining function. For those who have less than $5,000, then you get 30% of those expenses claimed as a credit, where it declines to zero for those individuals who have income above $45,000. So one component or one interesting thing to remember about these credits is that they, many of them are limited, like your personal exemption credit is limited. Your tax paid to states is also limited by the amount that you has to be a tax that you paid on income that was taxed in both states. But the earned income and the working family and the child care, they're all phased out. You know, they're all designed for low-income people. And so this phasing out we'll see in an upcoming graph is pretty important in how credits then affect different income groups. Now, the total credits here, this just kind of spans this a little bit more, shows you a few more different credits that there are in Oregon. And just so everyone's clear, I think sometime you guys will probably go through the tax expenditure report in which in here you do get a great breakdown and an explanation of all these different credits. And so you can get a little more detail once you kind of begin to learn how to use that tax expenditure report for credits if you have questions. So with the income tax credits, personal exemption were 85% of all the credits in 2000. You see that roughly the taxes paid to other states was 4%. Then the next largest was other credits at 3%. And the other credits really encompasses some business credits. There's a pollution control credit. You have like a farm machinery and equipment credit, some alternative energy devices credits, and other business energy credits are kind of captured in that other credits. And then you've got your working family earned income, both about around 2%, and the dependent and child care credit around 2%. And then political contributions is only about 1%, and retirement income is about 1%. Now, this graph really kind of piggybacks on the graph that, like, Paul showed you last week, the J-shaped one, which comes from OTM, and it shows you the effective tax rates by different income groups. Well, this basically takes out the personal income tax component and really shows you the progressivity that there is in that overall tax structure with just looking at the personal income tax. So with this graph, what you see is that the lowest income Oregonians, those between $0 and $10,000 in income, their effective tax rate, or in this case I'm calling it the average net tax, but it really is taking the total taxes that particular income group paid and dividing about the total amount of adjusted gross income that there is for that income group. And getting you a 2% of their income is paid in tax. And this is tax after credit. Okay, so if you had combined these and you looked at the tax before credits, you would see an even it would be a little bit flatter. It wouldn't be quite as progressive because the credits really adds to the progressivity of the income tax system. And that's why you're getting this sharp, you know, increase here in the, you know, progressive nature to the graph here is because you've got these credits that are quite significant there for the low-income Oregonians. So the low-income individuals under 10,000 get a 1.5% of their income credit. And then that goes up you know, is pretty stable there, about that same percentage, 10,000 to 20,000, and then it starts to decline. So as income grows for Oregonians, then their percent of their income that's a credit is declining. As their tax after credit, their effective tax rate is really rising. So you see, you go from a 2% tax net tax rate for those between 0 and 10,000 income all the way up to 8% for those that have income above 500,000. And they only have effective credit rate of probably 0.1% of their income. So this really, you know, just tries to help you understand that there is a lot of progressivity to the income tax system, and that really is the backbone of what is shaping our overall tax structure in the progressivity area.
Elizabeth, when you, going back to the graph we saw last week, when you superimpose property tax on that, that's what gives us the regressive tail on the low income, because that does bring in a higher percentage of income for low income tax, low income earners.
Yeah,
but this is just the income tax.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Yes, the property taxes and some of the excise taxes that add that regressivity to that J-shaped curve. And this really is the progressive component of our tax structure. It's right here. Now, to just go through some of the different distribution of tax returns, and you will begin to see some of this and get a sense for this once you see some of the distributional breakdown that we will be giving you in tables and things when we have different bills proposed, because you do get an understanding of the returns. But it's also kind of interesting to see how this has changed over the last 10 years. Now, what we see is in 2000, we have 1.6 million returns. And in 1990, we had 1.3 million returns. So you had an increase there of 300 million in taxpayers over the last 10 years. Now, what we see here, though, is most of these returns in the 0 to 10,000 income group, there was a drop in those returns between 1990 and 2000, which, you know, indicates the rise in our income per person or per tax return over the last 10 years. And then you see in like the $10,000 to $20,000 category, there wasn't much change. You know, basically there was just the movement of individuals from the 0 to 10,000 category on up to these other income groups. So from the $10,000 to $20,000, it was roughly the same. $20,000 to $30,000, you saw a little bit of an increase there in 2000, you know, maybe, you know, 15,000 people or so. And then 30 to 40,000, you see a little bit more of an increase. But the real jump, you know, you can see here is in these last three income categories. And so more of our tax returns are falling into the higher income categories over this period of 10 years. So between those and 40,000 to 60,000, you can see there's a jump of almost 100,000 returns. And then in the $60,000 to $100,000 category, that has jumped 200,000 in returns. And then on a percentage basis, really, the $100,000 and plus income group has seen the largest number of returns fall in that category. It's about triple the number that there were in 1990.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
These figures have not been adjusted for any inflation over the 10 years.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, that's correct.
Thank you.
Now, this is just to kind of move then from returns to now adjusted gross income, and AGI always means adjusted gross income, just so you know, that's something you'll see as an acronym pretty consistently here. And in 1990, what we saw is our total adjusted gross income, and this is for all returns, was $35 billion. Now, to kind of dissect it down into the different components, you can see that wages was by far the largest at 67% of the adjusted gross income was wages. And then you saw the second largest was interest and dividends at 9%. And then the next largest you saw was here in other. And the other includes things like alimony, IRA distributions, unemployment. Farms are in the other category, farm income. And then also between the next largest is pension, so any pension income that gets classified in that group. And then between the business is the next one, and the business category just includes sole proprietors. But this miscellaneous income of 3%, that also includes S-corporations, and so that also includes some business in there. Even though it's called miscellaneous, it also has rent and royalty income and estate income. So it not only includes S-corporations, it also includes, you know, some others. But you also could, if you wanted to, think in terms of how much businesses really contribute to the income of the state as far as small businesses. And again, this is not large corporations. Just the small businesses are the ones that are paying the personal income tax. But that's what the 5% tells you, as well as the 3%. And then the biggest thing to recognize here is capital gains was only 3% of the adjusted gross income in 1990. Now, we move to 2000. We haven't quite doubled our adjusted gross income, but nearly. We're at $66 billion, and that's just full-year returns. And our wages have gone from, we said before it was 67% of the adjusted gross income. It's gone down slightly, 65%. But what that tells you is that wages did not grow as fast as some of the other components of the adjusted gross income over the last 10 years. Now, the other thing that
But they're still almost double.
Representative Barnhart, I don't remember exactly if wages per se doubled. They definitely grew. I just don't know if they doubled the same, you know, proportionately. I don't think they doubled. There were other components that grew so much more faster than wages.
Right.
But yes, the overall income between 1990 and 2000, the adjusted gross income nearly doubled. Now, obviously the thing that jumps right out at you is the pension income grew from 6% to 10%. Well, that's showing, you know, the baby boomers retiring here in Oregon, more people who like to retire here in Oregon, also just moving into the state. And then the big one here is capital gains. And capital gains grew from, you know, just having 3% of the adjusted gross income in 1990 to now having 9% of the adjusted gross income in 2000. So that's really, these other components are what has grown so much, you know, that, and the interest in dividends, really, it was 9% there, and it really fell a little bit over the last 10 years. And that's, you know, there really is a connection here between the capital gains that you see versus the interest in dividends, because companies have to decide whether they're going to give dividends to their shareholders or they're going to retain those earnings and increase their stock value, and then the stock owners, once they sell their stocks, and they pay the capital gains. So there's, you know, a bit of a trade-off there between those two categories. So it's not surprising that interest and dividends would be going down at the same time capital gains would be going up.
Well, but just, again, this is 2000. I would expect, my gut tells me that if we were to look at a pie chart for 2002, capital gains would be a lot less than 9%.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that's correct. And I'll show you some other graphs as we're coming up on some of the declines and where the declines were, and they clearly were in capital gains. But this at least shows you how much we began to depend on these different components that, you know, many times are very volatile. And so with the business and the miscellaneous, they really didn't change too much over the last 10 years. And we'll get into more of that when we talk about the business and corporate income tax presentation next week.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. This is probably a very small point, but the only category in which the dollar figure probably went down was the other category. Could you give us an idea why that might be?
Representative Barnhart, one of the main reasons is because farms in 1990, if you look at some of that farm data, it's not all negative. There weren't all losses in 1990, but by 2000, the farms, almost all of them, all the different income groups had negative income. That's one of the biggest reasons. Also is unemployment. Unemployment in 2000, you know, was very small. Okay, so you've got unemployment payments in there, and those dropped significantly. So that's another reason why 2000 would be less than 1990 in the unemployment area.
So if I understand, what you're saying is that other includes farm income?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart, that's correct.
Thank you.
Includes farm income, which is many times negative, especially in recent years.
Right.
Okay, so now Representative Shetterly, or Chairman Shetterly, in order to answer some of those questions that you were bringing out about now what's really happened since 2000 and what are some of those changes and those what have happened to those major components. And this just kind of gives you a breakdown, and please realize this is preliminary 2001 data. Department of Revenue has not, you know, gone through all the returns yet or cleaned it all up and kind of gotten some of the bugs out of it. But this is kind of a snapshot of what we're going to be seeing now in the 2000 data, which was the beginning of the recession. Now, with first of all, the one that jumps right out at you is the drop in capital gains here of 53%. Okay, and that's between 2000 and 2001. And the other drop that's pretty big here is dividends of 22%. So again, as profits and earnings decline for corporations, and their amount of dividends that they're giving out is dropping. And interest, we've seen quite a bit of, you know, reduction in that interest for, so to be able to make much money and get much interest income, that has been harder. So you see a drop there in interest income of 1%. Wages, you can see, that only grew by 1%. Well, that's not even the rate of inflation, you know. So to see wages only grow by 1% is a little unusual and should send a little bit of a signal that, you know, there is a lot of unemployment going on in the state. And that's what I think you're seeing. There is a connection here between unemployment benefits. Boom, you know, they're up 62% from 2000. So unemployment, there's a real connection here between wages and you know, and it makes sense if somebody loses their job halfway through 2001, then they're moved out of the wage category and they're moved into the unemployment category.
Elizabeth, wages would also include bonus income and things like that as well, wouldn't it? Regular bonus income?
Representative Shetterly, yeah, just so long as it's not considered a dividend.
Right. I'm also speculating that apart from high unemployment or higher than unemployment that we've had in the last 10 years, I would expect also that small growth in wages would reflect a much more conservative approach toward bonus income and also a more conservative approach even toward pay raises, pay increases, certainly in the private sector, as employers are looking at their incomes probably growing at a much lower rate or even losing income perhaps. So apart from unemployment, I'm sure you've got stagnation there just in terms of the rate of wages being paid.
Yeah, Representative Shetterly, that's correct. And it's not, they can be reduced, furloughed, you know, maybe they're just laid off for a couple months or something, or even just reduce their hours. So there's a lot of ways in which the wages just may not be keeping up with the last year. And in 2000, there could also have been a lot of overtime and things that was paid. So, you know, there's a lot of fluctuations in the business cycle. And, you know, unemployment is kind of the extreme version. There's a lot of intermediate steps in between.
Ms. Newsberger?
Elizabeth, you have not put pensions in here, but clearly pension income will be increasing. You mentioned it yourself with the aging population and some retirements in this area. Mm-hmm. Is it going to be a significant? Percentage would it be on this chart?
Chairman Shetterly, Representative Berger, I haven't looked at pension income, so I really can't say. I can't.
Okay.
I have a list. I might be able to find it by.
We'll get to it eventually. Day. It just seems that it would be a larger percentage as these go down, and more and more significant as the population ages.
Chairman Shetterly and Representative Virgil. All I would say, though, too, is the IRA distributions, they were down like 4% there, and I think that's due to the, you know, stock market and that kind of thing. So as much as the pension income may be also tied to some of those stock market changes, then that may be something that has a negative effect on it. Okay, so as you can see, business income there in the business and the miscellaneous category only dropped 2%, 3%. So I think what you're seeing there is you're still seeing some growth in those small businesses. So you got new people coming in as well as, you know, some of the existing businesses maybe not realizing the same earnings and profits. So to kind of break down now the adjusted gross income components, we've all been talking about them, but just to kind of show the difference now between 1990 versus 2000, and this really does help you see where the tax is being, what income group is paying the majority of the tax. But you see here in 1990, again, we had $35 billion. The lowest income group between those under $10,000 in income, you can see that the salary and wages were the majority of that component. And then you had a little bit of dividends and interest income in that category. A few small businesses in that group, maybe they're just starting out. And then you see some pension income in that group. And then other, again, can be the unemployed, can also be the farms. And so in the 0 to 10,000 category, though, they're only paying $2 billion of the $35 billion as far as the percent, or as far as the amount of income that they're contributing to the total adjusted gross income for the state. Now, as you move up to the $10,000 to $20,000 income groups and the $30,000 to $40,000, they're really quite similar. You'll see in the first $10,000 to $20,000 income group, the dividends and interest is a bit bigger, and you've got some, you know, seniors in that income category, and then you've got business that is about the same in all three of those different income groups, as well as pensions and other. Now, the biggest thing to recognize here about the 1990 adjusted gross income is the $40,000 to $60,000 income group. You can see that's quite large. It's almost $8 billion. Well, that's about, you know, a seventh of the of the total adjusted gross income for the state. And so you've got the majority of the income being paid by people in with kind of moderate income, you know, $40,000 to $60,000. And then what you see is that income group, you know, has some dividends and interest, and then a large portion of businesses are in there. You've got some capital gains that are beginning to show up in that $40,000 to $60,000 category. And then pensions are there, and a small amount of miscellaneous. Again, miscellaneous are some S corporations, rent and royalty income, and then other is a large portion of that. So as you move to the $60,000 to $100,000 category, what you're seeing then is less of the other income groups. You're seeing a little bit more of the miscellaneous and business income in the higher income categories. And the dividends and interest is growing the most, or is the highest, in the 100,000 and more income group. And the capital gains is seen the most in that income group of 100,000 or more. But see, the capital gains here is not even a billion as far as value wise. Now, we move to 2000.
Okay.
Now we've totally changed the structure of the tax, of where the income is being paid. You know, we used to have this nice little hill in 1990. Now we have an exponential curve where the group in the 100,000 plus category are really paying nearly half of all, or, you know, they are comprising nearly half of all of the income in the state, where they're almost at $25 billion of the $66 billion of full year returns. And the other interesting part is to look at what percent are wages. As we saw in 1990, you know, wages were, for most of the income categories, it was the majority of the total income, with the exception of the $100,000 category. We see in 2000, then, the $100,000 income category has, you know, just about little over $12 billion of their total 24, you know, just wages. So these other components have grown significantly, and you see capital gains here is now over $4 billion. It was only $1 billion, and just this income group, it's over $4 billion, and just the 100,000 plus income groups. And you see the miscellaneous. This is the S corporations. They're all in the highest income category group. You also see that the other sole proprietors businesses are also in the highest income group. And dividends and interest are largest there in the 100,000 and plus category. So what you're seeing there with the 100,000 plus category, we saw that there was an increase there in the number of returns that are now in this 100,000 and plus income group. But what you're seeing are all these additional income that is now in this. It's not just wages. You know, it's these dividends and interest. It's other business income. It's pension income. You know, it's capital gains. So you're seeing many of these returns have multiple sources of income. Where these other, like if you contrast that with the 0 to 10,000 income group, you know, the majority of that is all wages with, you know, a little bit of business income and a little bit of pension and a little bit of dividends and interest. But this is really the story. We're seeing now that most of the income in the state is being held by those that are 100,000 or more in income. Now, to kind of give you an understanding of the average adjusted gross income over the last 10 years. In 1990, the average adjusted gross income was only $26,610 versus now where it's $43,615. Now, we saw how the distribution of returns changed over time, but this is, you know, this really kind of helps you see that for most of these income categories, you know, 0 to 10,000, 10,000 to 20,000, you know, all the way up until probably 60,000, the increase in the number of returns and the increase in income was pretty comparable. It was pretty proportional. So that really on an average basis then, you didn't see much change between 1990 and 2000. But then you see the $60,000 to $100,000 category, you see a small little jump there in 2000, you know, to cause that average to go up a little bit, meaning that there were probably more additional sources of income coming in. The income was rising higher than the number of returns that were coming in. But the big jump clearly is in the $100,000 category. You know, there you see that there was an average increase there from roughly $200,000 in 1990 on average to $225,000 on average. So that's a pretty big jump over 10 years for that top income group.
Representative Barnhart, this question.
Thank you. A couple of things about this chart puzzle me. If I understand what you're saying correctly, these bars are the averages within the category. So if a person were to make $10,000, $9,500 in 1990 and make $11,000 in 2000, they would switch categories. Is that right?
Representative Barnhart, that's correct. Yeah.
Okay. Second thing, have you considered using the median instead of the mean as a descriptive statistic? And the reason I ask the question is because when you're dealing with very skewed data like this, we think of the average as a number that sort of gets us to the middle of things. In a situation in which numbers are distributed normally, as in a normal bell curve, but a median might actually be more descriptive of the middle number when you're talking about highly skewed data like this. Have you considered expressing or putting out that as a way of describing the middle number rather than the average?
Chairman Shetterly and Representative Barnhart, all I would say is that this is the way. I don't have all the tax returns myself, you know, in my office. So what we rely on the Department of Revenue in their publications, and this is the way that they have chosen to publish the information is on an average basis. And it's not that they couldn't give me the median, but it is something that it's not the way that they report it, and I would have to get that additional information from them. As far as the median, though, I will say that it doesn't give you an understanding of the extremes. Yes, there are, these elements out there that are pushing up the average, but it also, it doesn't give you an understanding of what the range really is when you're just looking at a median, what's in the middle.
I guess it serves different purposes. I mean, I think it's worth keeping that perspective in mind. I guess between my income and your income and Bill Gates' income, we have an average income
of
$3 billion. That's right. Yeah, that doesn't tell the whole story. Although, yeah, that's where the income is coming. That's where the money is coming from into the returns or flowing through the returns by those averages.
Well, if I could, Mr. Chair, just one final comment on this point. If you're looking at the 1990 AGI components, that it's not a normal curve, but it looks more like one.
Mm-hmm.
By the time you look at 2000, it's not even close.
That's right.
And so the Revenue Department ought to start thinking about publishing both of these numbers together rather than simply publishing averages, which has less and less meaning as you start getting a curve that looks more and more like your chart number 19.
Well, Deborah is writing that down even as you speak, Representative Barnhart. So, Representative Williams.
Elizabeth, I was interested in sort of, and I know you don't have the census data to answer this question correctly, but based on what we're seeing since 2000, if you were to apply the 2001, 2002 numbers to this, what would you expect to see that next line on your chart suggest?
Chairman Shetterly and Representative Williams, well, the average would definitely go down, and I think it would go down most significantly in this 100,000 group because that's where all the capital gains are. I mean, that's
right.
The main reduction.
So we'd see a number that, would you anticipate that the number would drop below the red line, or would you expect that we would still be above the red line, the red comparator from 1990?
Yeah, Chairman Shetterly and Representative Williams, I don't think it dropped below the red line, no. Now, all I would add here is that with the median, it's not going to fluctuate a whole lot, between 0 to 10,000 and even 30 to 40,000. I mean, the real fluctuation and the difference there really is overall,
right,
for the whole state and this 100,000 category.
Right.
There's no question there's a huge range between this $100,000 category. And, that would be interesting to see what is the median there in that $100,000 category. But the others, I mean, I know it's a big point of discussion, and but I don't think you would see real big differences between the median in these different groups. Now, the median for the state, yes, it is not 43,615. It's more like 26,000. Yeah. So it definitely is lower on a statewide basis and in this $100,000 category.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right about that comment. Yeah.
Okay, so unfortunately, you have to deal with the average all the rest of the presentation here. But this is I've now split out the average AGI by different counties to really just kind of graphically and geographically represent where the change has been, and trying to help everyone see now the real difference that we're seeing between rural Oregon and urban metro areas. So to begin with, this, as we saw before, the statewide adjusted gross income is $43,000. There's now the lowest adjusted gross income in the state is in Wheeler County there at $26,143 versus Washington County up there with $63,409. So that's then a difference now of $27,000 roughly between the lowest income county and the highest average income county. And all this graph is really doing as far as the counties that don't have any color at all have an average adjusted gross income of less than $30,000. Those in the yellow, which are roughly 22 counties, have adjusted gross income between $30,000 and $40,000. And then those in the blue there, you've got seven different counties, and those are in the $40,000 to $50,000 county, or $40,000 to $50,000 average AGI. And those are really the counties that you've seen some growth now over the last 10 years. You've seen quite a bit of expansion. Deschutes has seen a lot of expansion, new businesses coming in. Columbia County, the same, you know, some of that metro area effect. But I think one of the things to recognize, because most of us think all the metro area is the same. I mean, Washington County is the same as Multnomah County. Well, it's really not. You can see there the adjusted gross income is, you know, quite a bit of difference between the two, with Multnomah only having $48,265 as an average adjusted gross income versus the $63,409. So there's only two counties that are above $50,000 in adjusted gross income, and that's Washington and Clackamas. So now to move to the tax, and I guess with the adjusted gross income, you're going to see pretty comparable, you know, similarities then when you look at the average tax. And again, over the last, you know, 10 years, since 1987, we haven't seen any tax rate change, so all this, you know, tax is due to any changes that we've seen in the income. Now, again, you can see that Wheeler County was the lowest county with an average tax of $1,348 versus Washington County with an average tax of $4,147. So there you can see that the difference is, you know, about $2,800 as far as the difference now and the disparity in the average tax that taxpayers are paying. Between Washington County and the 4,000 versus Wheeler County, only in 1,300.
Representative Berger has a question.
Yes, Elizabeth, Coos County always has an unemployment figure several points or more higher than Curry County, and yet their tax is a little bit different. Would that be that the people who are working in Coos County are working at higher wages than those in Curry? What does that mean?
Chairman Shetterly and Representative Berger, that could be one reason. Yes, there could be some higher paying jobs in there. There also just may be the number of people within the county also. Coos County, I'm sure, is more populated than Curry. And again, these are averages depending on the, you know, denominator being the number of returns in your county. So as your number of returns grows, you know, then that that's just something to consider. It's also the number of people as well as the amount of tax. That tax could be a function also of the wages that are being paid.
And I think particularly for Coos County, it may be a retiree issue. In 2000, you probably had good capital gains income to the extent that Coos is a stronger magnet for retirees than Curry County. I don't know if it is, but...
Brookings would be a strong retirement center. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think it may be, but the unemployment figures are quite different.
Okay. If I may add, Mr. Chair, Curry County does have the oldest average age, the highest median age in the state. It is there. Has the highest percentage of retirees. Remember, retirees are going to be taxed at a lower rate.
At a lower rate.
Because their Social Security income is excluded. They have an additional deduction. So I would guess that's the reason, is the age distribution between the two counties.
If there are any other questions on this, I guess the main point to remember here is you've only got four counties that are in the 0 to 1,000 that have tax between 0 and 1,500. And that's Wheeler, Lake, Kearney, and Mallard. And the rest are all above $1,500 in 2000. Now, what happened 10 years ago? What do you think, you know, that this graph looked like then? Well, everybody had between $0 and $1,500 as an average tax in 1990. And you only have four counties there up in the metro area with Washington, Multnomah, Clackamas, and Columbia that had above $1,500. And even then, they were all less than $2,000. And so the point is, you know, the difference between, you know, these these counties, that range of average tax has really grown over the last 2 years, or over the last 10 years. So that is something that I think really kind of spurs a lot of the debate on taxes also, is just because people have seen then this change in certain areas where they're paying more taxes versus the rural areas where in some respects they haven't gone up much at all. You know, like Wheeler only started at $857 and went up to $1,300 as an average tax. And this difference here between Washington at $1,870 versus Wheeler average tax is $857 is only about $1,000 difference versus the $2,800 that we're now seeing in 2000. Now to move away from some of the geographical issues is to just kind of help everyone make sure that they're clear that when we many times think of taxes, we think of April 15th, and we think that that's when everyone pays their taxes. Well, that is a time when you're rectifying your tax liability. But one point to remember is how much tax we bring in and how many, you know, people really are paying the tax throughout the year in which the tax is based on. So in tax year 2000, what we saw here, this gives you the number of returns that actually had tax withheld from their wages. And the total number of returns in that year was 1.4 million, and you can see that withholdings here, the number of returns that had some tax withheld was basically 1.2 million. So you had almost, you know, 83% of the total returns had tax paid in that tax year of 2000. Now, estimated payments is another way in which people will pay their taxes during the tax year, and estimated payments are very helpful for people who many times are self-employed or they run their own business and they may just want to make estimated payments rather than monthly withholding a certain portion. So the estimated payments there were roughly 12% of all returns. And another thing that, so basically what this shows is that most 95% of all returns that were paid in 2000 had money that was set aside in that tax year. It wasn't just paid in April of the following year. And another myth is that a lot of people think that when April 15th comes around, you gotta owe, you know, the government. Well, what this really shows is that in tax year 2000, tax refunds were nearly double the taxes that actually had to pay something. So taxes paid were only 401,840 returns had to actually pay something on April 15th of 2000. But the tax refunds were not, there were 954,934 returns that had tax refunds. Okay, that's the majority of the people who filed in 2000 had refunds. And it also shows you how well withholdings do in being able to predict how much tax you're going to owe. And as we'll see here, the tax refunds, though, as far as the dollar amount, were only $556 million versus the taxes that were paid with returns of $424 million. So the tax refunds on an average basis, or tax refunds per return, were smaller than the tax amount that was actually paid per return. But what you see here is that of the $4.2 billion of tax that was due in 2000, we saw that tax withholdings were $3.16 billion, and estimated payments were $872 million. So, you know, again, this estimated payments were roughly 21% of all the taxes that were paid, and withholdings were roughly 75% of all the taxes that were paid. Now, this is a graph that I kind of want to switch gears a bit, and hopefully this is something that provides a little insight to you and understanding a little bit about the different industries and what's been happening to the industries in particular since we've had our recession. Now, the Department of Revenue Research has been compiling a database that basically categorizes personal and corporate income tax receipts and these withholding payments by different industry sectors. And so this is the next industry groups that are being categorized, but they've taken every employer and basically placed them into one of these different categories, and then now we're going to be looking at the withholding payments for a given year and looking at it on an index basis. And when, and the index is beginning here in September of 1998, and that becomes the basis for the index. And all these lines are showing how much these monthly withholding payments that are, correspond to a month from the prior year, how much those monthly withholding payments actually have grown since September of 1998. So September of 1998 is one. It's the beginning of the index. And as you can see, like in October of 1998, what that shows you is how much the index changed from September of 1998 to October of 1988. And October of 1998 withholdings is not just one month. It's an entire year. It's from October of 98 till from October of 97 all the way ending October of 98. So it's one full year of withholdings, and then what we're doing is dividing it by September, our reference year, September of 1998. So that represents all the withholdings for the past year from September of 97 till September of 98, and then that becomes the index. And how much that index grows shows us how much change there was on a percentage basis in these different industry sectors. Okay, so as you can see, this graph pretty well, these are there are seven different sectors there, with the black line there being for all the sectors combined. Now, you can see the pink is the finance and insurance sector. Red there is manufacturing. Blue is education. Green, the dark green there is wholesale trade. The kind of the yellow there, mustard yellow, is healthcare. The blue, the real pretty light blue is retail trade, and the bright pink is public administration. And public administration includes, you know, like all local and state government. But the thing to remember as we're looking here is we can see that all the way until, you know, roughly January of 2001, you can see that all those sectors were pretty well, you know, rising. It looked like a pretty healthy economy, and as you can see here, like we'll take the all category. In January of 2001, we see that the index there is roughly 1.2. Well, what that means is that from September of 98, all sectors have grown 20%. And that's what an index of 1.2 is telling you. Now, what happened then, since January of 2000, well, it hit 1.2, it grew 20%, but then it started leveling off there. That other category really has not changed a whole lot over this time period from January of 2001 all the way until it's dropped, you know, maybe 5% between that period of 1991. Or January of 2001 to November of 2002. The thing to recognize here are some of these other industries that saw a decline here and really are representing some of the losses in the Oregon's economy. And that's the red here, and the red again is manufacturing. The manufacturing sector has even dropped below the level it was at in September of 1998. Now, you see some of these other industries that, you know, have been struggling too, like retail trade. Well, retail trade has, you know, seen a real decline here since January of 2002. Now, the wholesale trade, which is the green sector here, this also has seen some decline, a pretty big decline. It was all the way up to almost, you know, over 25% growth from September of 98, and it's fallen now to be only about a growth from 1998 of only about, you know, 10%. Public administration and education, these have grown, but they've started to flatten out now since about January of 2002. And the two main industries that you can see here that have grown, and those are the healthcare industry there in the mustard colored, and the public administration. And those two, and with I'm sorry, not and the finance and insurance. So the finance and insurance, you can imagine, because of the refinancing that has really helped in booming that industry. And with healthcare, there's just a lot of new sub-sectors of the healthcare industry that are being developed. Now, I'm going to take this
Madam Vice Chair, can I answer a question?
Yes.
Elizabeth, I understand from your description of why perhaps the finance and insurance one would be as strong given the activity associated with the low interest rates and refinancing. I guess I'm still a bit mystified about healthcare. I mean, we all understand sort of the rising healthcare costs that we're all talking about and that it's had an impact on so many businesses. But is it simply because those rates continue to climb and because they're not offsettable to the same degree that appears to be as strong as it is, or is there some other thing motivating the strength in that particular industry?
Well, Representative Williams, it is because of the cost. I mean, that is one component of the withholdings and stuff. So how many people are, you know, employed in that industry, and that's kind of one thing to remember when we start looking at this withholding index. The major things that are changing it is the number of hours that people would work, the salaries that they would get, and the number of employees that they actually have. So I think the healthcare industry is, and I think this also has to do with Oregon OHSU. Thank you. That industry, I mean, that, you know, university is also captured in that healthcare category.
It just has the appearance of being almost recession-proof. in the impact, and yet I find that to a certain degree, I mean, I understand it, but I also find it to a certain degree surprising that it wouldn't be sensitive to that issue at all. Is there something else driving that, Paul, that we're not seeing?
Representative Williams, if you look at the employment numbers in the healthcare sector, they've continued to grow throughout the recession. It has been the strongest sector in terms of job growth. So, you know, I mean, it's the flip side of the business costs, business and government costs rising rapidly. That's income into that sector. And so that's what's pushing up that withholding. Now, you could also look at that and say, well, that's probably not sustainable over time, where that sector is growing a lot faster than everything else, and that's what we're seeing in terms of healthcare costs rising as a percentage of the economy. And I think that's what that's reflecting.
It's just interesting to me. You look at the red line in comparison to that yellow line, and you wonder how are we going to pay for a healthcare system that's sort of growing at that rate when we are, you know, when our key manufacturing index is riding along the bottom of the chart.
Elizabeth, one of the things, though, that it seems to me would be driving that would be the research in the biotech. I mean, that's the shift in emphasis even now with the economy where it is, that they want to put more into that section of the economy. So if that is going to be the case, both at Oregon State University and at OHSU, mm-hmm. wouldn't that number continue as mm-hmm. it is?
Representative Berger, that's correct, yeah. And I'll just bring up one other point, too, is that the pensions are all incorporated in the finance and insurance sector, so that's another reason why that one is growing pretty strongly, too. So again, the payments that, you know, local governments and state government is making to PERS are incorporated into finance and insurance. Well, there are more examples of this. If this is something that you would like to see more of, the Department of Revenue Research does a lot of different tables, and this is just one snapshot of this index that they have created. Now, I just wanted to take one more time, just kind of help you see what are the sectors that have really been seeing the decline since between July of 2001 and November of 2002 with just the withholdings. And what we saw, like from our graph, is the manufacturing sector went down 89.7 million in between this time period for a percentage change of roughly a drop of 13%. Wholesale trade dropped $43 million for roughly about 16% decline. Construction dropped also for roughly 29.6 million and for roughly 13% drop. Information, which includes media, both in print as well as television, that dropped 24 million for roughly 17% drop. Professional and scientific and technical services, they dropped 16 million for roughly 7.8% drop. Retail industry dropped about 14 million or roughly 5%. But really the one that fell the largest is arts, entertainment, and recreation. And that industry is definitely feeling, is not recession-proof, and it dropped 26% for 8.6 million in losses during this time period. And utilities dropped about 11% or 6.8 million, and transportation and warehousing dropped 5.6 million or 4%. And mining dropped about 11%. Now, the total of what I've shown you here are just the sectors that are declining, of about a total of 21 different sectors. And this total here was 238 million. But just recognize that this withholdings is just one component. You know, during 2001 and 2002, we've seen a huge increase in refunds. And that's an important thing to recognize, that withholdings really weren't always reflecting how much people really were going to be paying when April 15th rolled around. There were a lot of refunds that were given out during this time period. And refunds have grown 50%. It was not something we brought up before, but back here in our components here, refunds grew 51% between 2000 and 2001. So that's a huge jump in just understanding that withholdings for our personal income tax are not always representing, at least in 2001 and some of these years when we have a recession, are not always representing what we're going to actually be collecting. We may have big refunds to be giving out.
Madam Chair, Lisbeth, the arts, entertainment, and recreation category that you identified at the 26.3%, does that include hotel, tourism, lodging? I mean, is it all of that industry associated in arts, entertainment, and recreation, or is that a more narrow category?
Representative Williams, that's a more narrow category.
Okay.
Yeah, there is another category that's dealing with just restaurants and hotels. So again, I've just shown you the sectors that are falling, and if you wanted to further investigate, you know, all the different components, we could show you the ones that were rising over this time period.
Mr. Chair,
yeah,
on the last, yeah, that one. Mm-hmm. If I've read this correctly, manufacturing and wholesale trade together are over half of this total, mm-hmm. in raw dollars,
right.
Not in percentages. Now, could you describe just a little bit what wholesale trade is? Is it connected with manufacturing, or is it something different?
Well, Representative Barnhart, that would be when manufacturers will sell to, like, an intermediary who would then sell it to a retailer. So, you know, I mean, you can have manufacturing involved, but it's not like, if they're in the manufacturing of a particular, like a chip or something like that, that's what their primary...
They're not being double counted.
They're not being double counted.
Right, if I may, let me ask it a different way. Wholesale trade in Oregon, it's going to come from manufacturing. That is, a manufacturer makes something, the wholesale trader buys it, mm-hmm. and then ships it out of state and then sells it. And so if the manufacturing is down, then we'd expect wholesale trade to be down too, or vice versa. Have I got that more or less?
Representative Barnhart, yeah, no, that's correct. I mean, the two have to be connected, and also retail trade, you know, in many respects is connected with wholesale trade also. So.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so I'm going to leave this, you know, industry data for now, but again, we can revisit this if this is something that you're interested in knowing more about. Now, I just want to make sure it's clear, and I'll just kind of briefly go through this because I know we're kind of running out of time, but kind of who has to pay Oregon taxes, you know, so everyone's clear. Obviously, full-year residents pay Oregon taxes, but there are taxes assessed on part-year and non-residents in certain conditions. And the state basically has to have a nexus to tax income that is earned by residents and that income from other Oregon sources that are earned by non-residents. And for to begin with, like a part-year resident, we can always just think of the person who lives in Oregon for 6 months and then moves to California, and then they've lived here for half the year, and so they've had some Oregon income here, but then they've moved away. So they would be considered a part-year resident. And the same thing if you moved from, say, like California, and you lived there for 6 months, and then you moved up here to Oregon. So then you would be a part-year resident here in Oregon. And with non-residents, what you can think of here, and then most common one we talk about are, you know, the people who live in Vancouver, Washington, and commute across the bridge here in Oregon. They are non-residents, but they will be paying Oregon income tax. And also the absentee landlord, you could be someone who is a Vancouver resident and you own a home in Portland as a rental home, and you get rental income off of that, then that would be such that you would be paying income tax on that rental income that you're earning here in Oregon. Now, just a quick example, and there's several others there in your handout too, but I won't go into a lot of detail on that. I just want to, the main point I want to make here is that when you're looking at the part-year and non-resident taxpayers, you really need to be looking at what portion you're going to calculate your federal adjusted gross income just like you would normally, but then you're going to also be looking at what portion of that total federal adjusted gross income, what portion of that total income was actually earned here in Oregon. And in this particular case, if you say, like, use the rental property example, if you got $5,000 in rent throughout the year as a non-resident, then you would be having that portion of your federal income then would be taxed here in Oregon. But it's just that Oregon source income that's actually going to be taxed. So what you calculate is this Oregon percentage, which then is just your total of your adjusted gross income that's actually here in Oregon divided by that total adjusted gross income at the federal level. So in this particular example, it would be 25%. So what you do is just use that Oregon percentage to calculate then a portion of your taxes that would be actually apportioned here to Oregon. And so for part-year residents, you're basically looking at, you know, that resulting tax that would be from Oregon then be apportioned to Oregon based on this ratio then of that percentage. And for non-residents, what you do is just take this portion, this 25%, and apply that to the federal tax, the deductions, the itemized deductions, as well as the credits. So the credits are also apportioned according to this percentage that you have of what Oregon, what income you earned here in Oregon versus the other states. So I don't think it's that critical that you know all this in great detail, but it's just something that just so everyone's aware, part-year residents do pay Oregon income tax, and so do non-residents under certain conditions. Now, to just look real briefly, the last component of the when you're filing your income taxes is to decide whether you want to give a donation. And so we have the checkoff donation kind of tally here from tax year 2000. And you can see there were 585,000 donations in 2000. And the largest donation recipient was the child abuse prevention at 25% of those total donations. Then we had Alzheimer's research and the non-game wildlife at 19% each. And then you had the stop domestic violence at 16% of the total and the AIDS HIV education at 12%. And then Habitat for Humanity was 4% and Head Start was 3%. So,
Elizabeth, now we have the checkoff donations that are on the form and some that are in the book. Right?
Representative Chevrolet, I don't remember.
Thanks. Isn't that right? Yeah, Deborah is telling me I'm correct. That some of them are actually printed on the form, and then there's kind of a sub a second tier, I guess, that we've put in the instruction book that you can, if you look hard enough, you can find. And I'm curious, do these, maybe you don't know then, whether it's Dee or Deborah, do you know, do these represent, or in 2000, did we have them in the book? They were all on the form in 2000. Okay.
They were all
on the form. It seems to me, was it the Veterans Home was one that we looked at? I don't remember what all. About 17. Okay, so they're growing.
How many are going to be on the form, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, from the book.
Right.
Okay, so
but everybody wants to be on the form.
That's right.
That's the jockeying for position is everybody wants to be on the form.
For the record, Deborah just told us that there are a total of about 17. Just the ones reflected on this slide are the ones on the form. There's a supplemental list in the book, the instruction book, then that you can choose from to add on to your form. That was Deborah Buchanan from the Department of Revenue. Thank you.
So are there any other questions on just the personal income tax?
Just to say for committee, these are some of the more spirited hearings we have sometimes on folks wanting on the form or in the book or wanting to boot somebody off the form so they can get on. It is true.
Okay, we'll just briefly go through the surplus kicker and then some of the changes that potentially could be coming with federal law and state law changes. Now, with the kicker, I know you all are pretty familiar with what the kicker is, but basically at the beginning of each biennium or at the end of each biennium, you're going to be examining then the total amount of corporate income tax revenues that are exceeding 2% of the close of service estimate. And again, the close of service estimate is based on the May forecast each biennium. So if the corporate income tax revenues are exceeding 2% of that close of service estimate, then that entire excess is credited to the corporate taxpayer. And it's credited in proportion to how much tax they paid. Then the other calculation that is performed is on other general fund revenues, not the corporate revenues, but all the other general fund revenues, and looking at whether or not those revenues exceeded the close of service estimate by 2% or more. And then if it does exceed 2% or more, then what you can see is the entire excess is refunded to the personal income tax payers. So I think the main point to recognize here is this close of service estimate is, you know, put out by DAS and OEA, and that estimate is, you know, really based on the May forecast, which has to forecast 2 years in advance. You know, for two full years, they have to be able to predict both the corporate and the general fund revenues, and that is the basis for whether or not we have a kicker, is how well the state economists can predict 2 years in advance, you know, these different trends. And as we've seen over the last year, that is very difficult, especially when you're in a recession period.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I have a question maybe for you or for Elizabeth on the constitutional change on the kicker law. If we wanted to tweak that, for example, a lot of people complain that if you go 10 cents over 2%, you know, that has to be the entire 2%, and some people think that should be graduated in or whatever. But if we wanted to make a change like that, how does that constitutional change that the voters passed a few years ago affect that?
I think any change now in that would have to be done with a constitutional amendment.
Okay.
So I think at least in that respect, I'm 99% sure that is all part of the constitutional provision relating to the kicker.
So that any even technical tweaks.
Yeah. Of course, I think I maybe I'll get to it, but of course, for this biennium anyway, it's academic.
Yeah.
So as Chairman Shetterly just pointed out, for this biennium, which is the last line here, the 2001-03 biennium, you know, we have had a drop of 1.1 $4 billion basically in our personal income tax. Our corporate has dropped $464 million. So there is not any way we would have a kicker at all this biennium. I guess what this kind of shows you, though, is that it's 12 different bienniums here that we have had the kicker, and we had 7 bienniums where we had a personal income tax kicker and 5 bienniums with a corporate income tax kicker. And the largest personal income tax kicker was in 1995 with $432 million. On a percentage basis, the largest was in 1985-87 with nearly a 17% kicker. And on the corporate side, with the 5 different times that we've had a kicker, the largest corporate kicker was in 1995-97 at $203 million, which is 42%. And on a percentage basis, it was the prior biennium, the 93-95 biennium, where it grew 50. We had a 50% kicker. And I think if you remember from those first, the second slide we saw about how there started to be this growth in the mid-90s with the corporate income tax, well, that was just something that was hard to predict from an economist's perspective, that, you know, that nice flat little line that had been, you know, pretty consistent for the corporate income was going to, you know, take off like that. So those are the kind of things that it's hard then for an economist to be able to predict these, you know, real big swings from biennium to biennium. And that really is the basis for the corporate, or for these, the kickers. And basically, and when these kickers go out, it's in the fall of the end of that biennium. So like in the 99-01 was the last year we had a kicker, and it was $254 million for personal income taxpayers. And that went out in the fall of 2001. So at the end of the biennium is when then those checks come in that fall period. Now, to just kind of briefly go through Measure 28, I just wanted to make sure everyone was clear. I know there's a few new people on the committee. So, and I've been getting a lot of questions on Measure 28 that kind of get fed in from the Secretary of State's office. But there's been a few questions on just the timing of some of this impact and stuff. So as we all know, this Measure 28 was passed during the fifth special session, and it's increasing that top personal income tax rate, just that top one, to 9.5%. Then it's increasing the corporate tax rate, and we'll get into discussing corporate taxes next week, but it's currently at 6.6%, raising it 5% to 6.93%. And then that's a rate increase for 3 years, but that rate increase is beginning in 2002. It's beginning in tax year 2002, and again, we're going to be getting all that 2002 tax liability in this current fiscal year of 2002-03. Okay, now we're not only doing that, but then we're also getting a portion of the 2003 tax liability also. So what a lot of people get confused about is that they see this raises $313 million in tax year 2002-03 fiscal year, and then they expect that number to rise each year, okay? You need to help taxpayers understand that this is a year and a half, basically, a tax liability captured in the 2002-03 fiscal year.
Because we're getting the payments for 2002 plus for estimated. For instance, we're getting the April and June payments for 2003 that will be coming in during this fiscal year.
Yeah, and Chairman Shetterly, the Department of Revenue will be changing the withholding table to reflect that, you know, 1 month when we didn't collect the 2003, you know, January withholdings also. So there are mechanisms ready to be put in place once, if this measure passes, that would allow us to bring in as much 2003 tax liability as we can in the first 6 months. So that's why it's $313 million in 2002-03. Then in 03-04, I think it's like $242 million, and then it drops off further. And in the last year, in 2003-04, is the only year that really represents a full year of tax liability. And then in 2004-05 fiscal year, you really only have half a year of tax liability. So just to help people understand, it's not that we're predicting that we're going to have some shortfall in our, you know, economy. It's just that we have It's just the timing of things, and really this measure was designed and brought about during this September special session because of the shortfall in the current biennium, and that's, you know, why we were trying to bring in as much as we could right away. Oh, and the other thing to just make sure everybody knows, there, you know, there's the average tax increase of $114 per year that's out there, and then there's the tax table that kind of, you know, breaks down by different income group the average tax. But if people really want to know, you know, how much is Measure 28 going to cost me, the Department of Revenue now has put out with the tape with the new forms for tax year 2002, you can find two different tax tables. You know, one if Measure 28 passes, one if Measure 28 fails. You can calculate that from your federally adjusted gross income, calculate your taxable income, and then you can compare it on these tax tables. So you can find out right away, you know, what is going to be my impact from Measure 28. So for some people who really have a concern about how much this is going to increase their taxes, they can figure it out, you know, right away from the tax tables the Department of Revenue has. And if people don't have their own, you know, forms yet, you can get them off of the Department of Revenue's website. Now, we will probably be discussing this more later, but just to kind of give you a real brief overview of Bush's proposed economic recovery plan, and after talking with the Joint Committee on Taxation last week, they haven't even really seen formal legal language yet to kind of help in, you know, giving us some ballpark of these different estimates nationwide. But this is what would have been kind of discussed in the news about what will be part of the plan. And to begin with, we have elimination of double taxation on dividends, and this really is trying to look at the problem that, you know, exists in terms of corporations will be taxed on their earnings and profits, and that is becomes part of their tax base for all their earnings and profits. Then if they give dividends to their shareholders, then that shareholder has to turn around and report that as a dividend, and then that gets taxed at the personal income tax level. So that's where the double taxation comes in, but not all dividends would have this double taxation that would come into play. So that's one thing that we need to be examining in a little bit more detail, is what portion of the dividends would maybe not have double taxation. Now, this just kind of gives you a graph here of the dividends in 2000 and broken out by different income groups. And basically what you see is that the total dividend income was $1.5 billion. And the number of returns were 388,461. Well, most all of those returns were in the low were in the income groups between 0 and 80,000. Okay, that makes up over almost 80% of all the returns. But you can see most of the tax, or most of the income, dividend income, was really found in the higher income groups. So, as you can see, that if you look at this $1.5 billion and you apply a 7% tax rate, the total dividend estimated tax would be roughly $105 million in 2000. So this gives you a ballpark, at least, of the high end of where our dividend income, you know, may be removed from our tax base because of this federal law change. And so, again, this is this first one, the number one, is going to be a negative on Oregon's income tax, because as we were talking about, that federal adjusted gross income, it includes all the components of income, and one of them is dividends. And when you eliminate dividends from being part of that federally adjusted gross income, then you're also removing it from Oregon's base. So this is a negative to Oregon's income tax base. And then the next one here is there's going to be an acceleration of the 10% federal tax bracket. So this, again, is, you know, basically running a reduction then in the people who have to fall within this 10% income bracket expansion. So when more people are going to be falling into the 10% federal income tax bracket, that means there's going to be a reduction in taxes then for people. And then this lower tax amount then is going to cause a positive effect then in Oregon, as far as there's not going to be as much as large a federal tax subtraction from Oregon's tax base. So this would be a positive, this number two, positive for Oregon. And then the third one, accelerating the reduction in the income tax rates. Currently, the income taxes are between 10% and 38.6% in the six brackets. And by 2006, they will be reduced 2%. And so they would be then between 10% and 35%. So this reduction in the income tax rates, again, will be something that will lower federal tax liability. Then as it gets moved and transferred into Oregon's system, we'll have a smaller amount of federal income tax subtraction, which is a positive gain then for Oregon's income tax system. Same thing with number four there. You've got acceleration of the reduction of the marriage penalty. So, again, they're going to be eventually I think it's 2005, they're going to be increasing that marriage penalty or eliminating the marriage penalty. So it was currently, I think, $7,850, and then it's going to be doubled to $9,400 to be double the single, which is $4,700. So that is supposed to be phased in by 2009 under current law, but this would be accelerated. And then, again, once you're giving a bigger deduction, then you're going to be lowering federal taxes, and then the amount of Oregon federal tax subtraction will be less, and then you've got more Oregon taxes. So, again, that's another positive. And then in five, you've got an increase in the federal child care credit by $400. And this was something that was going to be phased in by 2010, and now this can be phased. This would be implemented right away, and so this again will cause a lower tax, federal tax for families, and then this would transfer then to a lower amount that could actually be deducted from Oregon taxes, and so you're going to have more Oregon taxes. And this increase in the business expensing threshold, this business expensing threshold will be increased from $25,000 to $75,000, and then it'll be indexed to limit the change in inflation. And similar to bonus depreciation, what this increase in the business expensing threshold is doing is going to be allowing when a business will buy a new investment in capital, then they'll be able to expense more up front. So they'll be able to not only take just $25,000, but they could take all the way to $75,000. So that increase in the threshold will increase the amount of, removal from the tax base. And, again, that's part of our adjustment then in the federally adjusted gross income. And that will be then a reduction in our Oregon tax base. So that's a negative. And then finally, the seventh one, which was providing similar tax relief to alternative minimum tax returns. Again, this has just been an increase in the deductions that is allowed for the alternative minimum tax returns. And again, this would lower the federal tax liability, which would then feed through as a higher amount that Oregon would be having in tax. So what you have are basically two negatives, but the one negative, number one, is pretty big. So you have two negatives to the state economy, and then you got five pluses through the feedback effects. So what we'll be doing in the next few weeks is going through and trying to get a little better estimate on dollar amounts for these different components.
And for the committee, of course, it remains to be seen what elements of these actually are enacted this year at the federal level and to what extent they're enacted or limited. So this is something we'll just keep an eye on and measure each of the components, the impact that they would have on state revenues. Mm-hmm. I know the states across the country are watching this with great interest. Elizabeth, anything else? We're running at the end of our time. We have a bill introduction. Are you done? I want to thank you. Questions from the committee? If you do, be sure to follow up with Elizabeth. Appreciate the review and slides. I think some excellent information in the slides. That will take care of our overview then for today. Committee, we have before us. Can we get the lights back up? Thank you. It's nice to have that controlled at the desk. Yeah. So having to go look for those switches in the closet. Thank you again, Elizabeth.
Yes.
And committee members, if you have questions, be sure to contact Elizabeth directly. We have before you, then we'll go to the next agenda item, bill introduction. This is bill draft LC 931. It's the tax revisers bill. This comes to us from legislative council working with the Department of Revenue and Legislative Revenue Office. For those of you who have seen revisers bill, it reveals you know what this is. For new members, just the way to read this is just to look at the note at the end of every section. These revisers bills are technical only, at least that's certainly the way they've been, and I think that's safe to say that's what this is. For instance, on page 3, line 4, that note there explains what section 1 does, corrects a subsection reference. And at the end of every section, there will be a note that explains what the preceding section does. And I don't know if LC has built in any gems, but in the past they've added some humorous, what was it, futzes with language, I think was one from last session that explained to us what one of the sections did in these revisers bill. But anyway, with that explanation,
Mr. Chair,
Representative Williams.
I move introduction of LC 931.
Representative Williams moves introduction of LC 931 as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Again, of course, this doesn't represent any indication of support or opposition. We're just getting it into the process. Any objection? Hearing none. LC 931 is introduced. And with that, I think we are to the end of our agenda, so I appreciate everyone's time and attention today, and especially, committee, the 8:30 start on this thing. I'll do my best to be down here to bang that gavel right at 8:30. It's great to get these things going on time. Thank you. With that, we're adjourned.